Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Trump's latest act of petty vindictiveness in killing two signature programs of Michelle Obama's to educate adolescent girls and the requirement for more nutritious school lunches nationwide to promote health and combat childhood obesity. Marion Nessel, a professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies and Public Health at New York University and author of Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health, and her latest Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning, joins us to discuss the announcement by the new Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, that the 32 million American kids who receive federally subsidized meals will now have more calories, fat, and sodium, and less whole grains, fruits, and vegetables in what is served in their school cafeterias. In other words, Donald Trump's favorite food, Big Macs and KFC, will be back. Then we'll speak with Paul Light, a professor of public service and the founding principal investigator of the Global Center for Public Service at New York University. His latest book is Government by Investigation, The President, Congress, and the Search for Answers, 1945 to 2012. He joins us to discuss whether the bipartisan agreement to avoid a government shutdown could be the beginning of the marginalization of President Trump, who is clearly unhappy with the deal and is now calling for a good government shutdown in September. Then finally, we'll look into the possibility that an impeachment of Donald Trump is all but inevitable, as his erratic and intemperate behavior with CBS's John Dickerson is compounded by his spectacular ignorance of American history revealed in Trump's claim that Andrew Jackson could have prevented the Civil War that took place 16 years after his death. Robert Kuttner, the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect and author of Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity Versus Possibility, joins us to discuss the growing evidence that the Republican Congress are not afraid of Trump and don't need him anymore. And joining us now is Marion Nessel, who is the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and a professor of sociology at New York University. She was senior nutrition policy advisor in the Department of Health and Human Services and has been a member of the FDA Food Advisory Committee and Science Board, the USDA DHHS Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, and the American Cancer Society committees that issue dietary guidelines for cancer prevention. She's also the author of Eat, Drink, Vote, an illustrated guide to food politics, Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health, and her latest book is Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marion Nessel.
Glad to be here.
So I have the impression, perhaps I'm a little bit too partisan here, but I have the impression that Donald Trump's or the Trump administration's killing Michelle Obama's programs, one to educate adolescent girls around the world and the other one to require more nutritious school lunches nationwide to promote health and combat childhood obesity. It strikes me as petty vindictiveness. And we know that this president, everything that Barack Obama has done, he blames all of his problems on Barack Obama, even though he's the president. He's got a Republican House, a Republican Senate, and now a Republican Supreme Court. So am I being unfair here, do you think?
Well, you're being unfair only in one way, and that is that you're not counting the political forces that have opposed Mrs. Obama's enterprises while she was trying to do it. And this is about business. I mean, it's pretty amazing to think that we would look at school lunches and say, oh, let's make them unhealthier. Let's feed our kids more junk food. I mean, if you look at it that way, it's complete. What's being done is completely ridiculous. If you look at it from the standpoint of companies that sell junk foods to schools, they have a huge vested interest in making sure that the school lunch nutrition rules are as easy as possible to meet so that they can produce products that and sell them in schools. That's what this is about. These are business decisions.
So the Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, is basically, and this, I think, didn't the Senate, the head, Roberts, the senator from Kansas, he's the head of the Ag Committee, he was pushing for this as well. So this is coming from agribusiness, do you think?
Well, it comes from agribusiness. In this case, it bizarrely also comes from the School Nutrition Association, which is the organization that represents the people, the school food service directors. And their leadership, certainly not the people who are in the schools, because the people who are in the schools are doing fine with Mrs. Obama's regulations. They're producing school lunches, the kids are eating them. There's really very, very little problem in most places. But in schools that have school food service directors that really don't care what kids eat, that don't want to do the extra work that's involved, that don't want to do the extra education, that don't want to cook foods, I mean, there are all kinds of reasons, or that simply don't want to be told what to do. There's those groups of people oppose the regulations very, very strongly. They lobbied in Congress, and now they're getting what they wanted.
So, again, the risk of being unfair. This has nothing to do with President Trump's predilection for Big Macs and Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Well, I don't think he thinks that food is very important, not to mention the Coca-Cola button on his desk. He doesn't think that eating healthfully is something that's important, that should be encouraged for children, that makes any difference in the way that people eat or the way that people live or their lifestyles. After all, he got where he is eating the way he does, so it must be just fine for everybody.
Well, but this is not everybody. This is 32 million American kids who receive federally subsidized meals. So from now on, they'll be having more calories, more fat, more sodium, and less whole grains, fruits, and vegetables.
And chocolate milk. That one came in today. You know, as I said, when I think about it, I think, how could anybody want kids to eat less healthfully? And the only explanation for it is that business interests are at stake. And instead of everybody, this should be a bipartisan issue. Everybody should want kids to eat more healthfully. Everybody should be looking for ways to give kids the best possible meals they possibly could get. Everybody, all kids should have these meals. The meals should be as healthy as possible. Who could possibly be opposed to that? And people are opposed to it because it's going to cost some people money, because some people don't want to bother, and because lots of people don't like being told what to do.
So does this mean then that there isn't a sufficient lobby for healthy foods, for fruit and vegetables?
There's not. I mean, one of the things that we've seen with the Trump administration so far is that if there's enough opposition, particularly opposition expressed, I think, within the White House, then he changes his mind. He completely reverses decisions that he said he'd made months or years or even days before. The fact that they were able to get away with this and that the new Secretary of Agriculture could just come in and do this right off the bat and get away with it means that there has not been enough organized opposition. And I'm hoping that what this will do is to galvanize people who care about food and health and food and the environment to protest as loudly and as long as they can.
Do you think that the daughter, who's supposed to be a Democrat and supposed to be interested in protecting the environment, and she's trying to sort of promote herself as being, I think, more compassionate than her father, or at least a positive influence on her father? What are the possibilities of Ivanka?
Well, I can't speak to Trump. Right. I can't speak to Trump family dynamics because I don't know anything about it.
Right.
But if this was something that she was interested in, presumably she would have acted and prevented this from happening. I mean, these seem like very, very small details, a difference in the amount of whole grain or a difference in the amount of sodium or adding chocolate milk back to the mix. They seem like very, very small matters, but they're not. They will make a difference to the healthfulness of the foods that are being served. Yes, they may be difficult for some of the school food service directors to deal with, but if they're creative, they ought to be able to figure out a way to produce meals that are healthy. There's no reason why healthy food shouldn't taste good. There are plenty of ways to make foods taste good without having to throw in a lot of salt or to add a lot of sugar. And I think the schools ought to be able to do that, and plenty of them are. I mean, what's so sad about this is that the vast majority of schools are managing with these regulations just fine. It's a minority that's not. So in a sense, this is catering to a noisy minority that had a lot of lobbying power.
Well, we have a minority president. I mean, he's three million votes short than Hillary Clinton, and if you add in the 10 million that went for Johnson and Jill Stein, he's very much the minority president.
Well, he certainly knows how to use it.
Right. So the argument then on the conservative side is this is yet another example of the overreaching nanny state. Is that's mm-hmm. pretty much what you said earlier. So then we talked about why isn't there a lobby for healthy food, grains, fruits and vegetables as opposed to a lobby for KFC and Big Macs. Is there a lobby for obese people? I mean, what is it, 60% of the country's obese or overweight, isn't it?
Well, I know there are organizations that represent people who are overweight, particularly concerned about the stigma that's attached to overweight. But the way our government seems to work is that powerful business interests that have lots and lots of money behind them are able to get what they want. This is a government that appears to be very, very interested in corporate health and not nearly so interested in the health of citizens or of the environment for that matter. So even though these school food rules seem very, very small, they're indicative of a much, much larger initiative that's going on. And that's why every single one of them needs to be fought back with data, with votes, with any way that people who care about these issues can make their voices heard, seems to me to be very, very important to do right now.
Well, it seems also that you can extend that notion in terms of national priorities reflected in Trump's budget, not the one that passed to keep the government going, but he's threatening.
But the one that's floating around.
Right. The one that he says back in September, he actually meant October, the good shutdown, which is he wants more money for defense. We know that. He wants to cut out money for diplomacy. He wants to get rid of public radio and public television, which, of course, plays against his constituency that believe him. And he tells everybody else that anything but what he says is fake news. And this is all to save trivial amounts of money, as is indeed the subject we're talking about now, these cuts in the nutrition program. But the priority of defense over everything else, again, seems to be in this category that you were just talking about. In other words, you know, we're all about power, projecting power, killing people, but not about healing people, making them healthy.
Or giving them a lifestyle that's filled with education, culture, and other kinds of things that make life much more pleasant. You know, we'll have to see how this budget plays out. There are things in it that do not reflect what the president had asked for, and it's going to be very interesting to see how Congress handles that. But for anybody who cares about NPR, this week or the national or the arts organizations or any of these things, this just requires a vast effort in advocacy, which, of course, a lot of people really don't know how to do and haven't done and are uncomfortable doing. So I want everybody to get out and run for office.
Well, everybody did get out, at least all the women got out the day after the inauguration, and they probably have a lot of sway, don't they, over what their kids eat?
They would have a lot of sway, but it's one thing to march on Washington, and it's another thing to use your people power to get what you think is the right thing to do. If all those women were sitting in government or sitting in Congress and insisting that what Congress ought to do is to give more money for school lunches, that would solve a lot of problems.
Well, just in closing, how do you do that? I mean, if they're all in the pocket of Kraft and Nestle and agribusiness. What's the counter lobby?
Well, the counter lobby is to, as you vote with your vote.
Mm-hmm.
You throw the bums out.
Mm-hmm.
And you start preparing to do that now and work on it. I mean, if you're dealing with politics, you have to use politics to do it. It's much harder to do with infinitely less resources, but it can be done. And small gains are important gains.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Marion Nestle.
Glad to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Marion Nestle, who's the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies and Public Health and Professor of Sociology at New York University. She was a Senior Nutrition Policy Advisor in the Department of Health and Human Services and has been a member of the FDA Food Advisory Committee and the Science Board and the USDA DHHS Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee and the American Cancer Society's committees that issue dietary guidelines for cancer prevention. She's the author of Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics, Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health, and her latest book is Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether the bipartisan agreement to avoid a government shutdown could be the beginning of the marginalization of President Trump. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Paul Light, who is a professor of public service at New York University and the founding principal investigator of the Global Center for Public Service. Previously, he served as the founding director of the Center for Public Service and director of the Governmental Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. He's the author of Thickening Government and the Tides of Reform, and his latest book is Government by Investigation, Presidents, Congress, and the Search for Answers, 1945 to 2012. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Light.
Thank you very much.
And what do you make, Paul Light, of the fact that the Republicans, at this point, they still haven't gotten their second bite of the apple on repealing and replacing Obamacare? They don't have the votes. The distinct impression is that they're not particularly good at governing, even though they've got the White House, the House, the Senate, and arguably the Supreme Court. Is this a case of their anti-government rhetoric catching up with them, or are they just incompetent?
Well, I think that the Republican Party remains sharply divided. The Freedom Caucus on the right is absolutely intransigent. The moderates, who are in borderline blue, red, purple districts, can't be moved. And then you've got kind of a solid 190, 200 members out of the 235 who can be moved, might be moved. I mean, we've seen this now for 6 years. John Boehner was forced out of the speaker's chair because the Tea Party, as it was known at the time, would not compromise. And now the Speaker, Ryan, is having the same problems. He cannot put together a governing coalition. None of this controversial legislation is making it to the Senate, where it would have face even greater difficulty. But you can't get it out of the House. It's just impossible. And we've seen this for a long time.
Well, but the deal that they just made to prevent a government shutdown, which was a bipartisan deal, Schumer and other Democrats are celebrating. It's got the White House extremely peeved. And Donald Trump is in full kind of PR mode, trying to make it look like it's not her humiliation, and that, in fact, he's already called for, what he's saying is our country needs a good shutdown in September to fix the mess. So that's pretty extraordinary, isn't it? Have you ever
heard
a president of the United States wanting the government to shut down?
Well, but, you know, the Democrats are wrong to celebrate right now, and they're kind of begging the president or baiting the president, which is fine, but it's like celebrating the world championship after winning the first game. They have a budget to pass by October 31st, although, or they will need another short-term continuing resolution. And there's a time for celebration, and there's a time for quiet glee, and the Democrats are making a mistake here. They're forcing the president's hand. The president is very much a bluffer. He said repeatedly that he was going to go to the wall, no pun intended, on this short-term bill. Now he's saying he's going to go to the wall and he's willing to shut down government in October. Democrats should keep their powder dry and just move forward. This is not a time to celebrate, from my perspective. Let the Republicans do what they're going to do or not do what they're going to do, and just stand by.
Well, of course, Donald Trump is making a silk purse out of a sow's ear in the sense that he's saying that the large increases in military spending and for border security in the bipartisan budget that was just passed, the temporary one to avoid shutdown, he's claiming victory, saying there's enough down payment for the wall, which is not true. The bill does not provide funding for the wall. And, of course, there was extra money for defense. But by and large, why the Democrats are celebrating, not to mention crowing, is that there weren't any great, you know, meat cleavers taken to their programs.
Well, we'll wait until October 1. The budget director has sent orders to the departments and agencies to prepare reorganization plans that will have very deep effects in the budget. And there's going to be a big fight over that budget. The president threatening a shutdown doesn't make a whole lot of sense, given that he's going to be forwarding a budget with deep cuts in it. He needs to hold fire as well. But I don't think the president has much reason to celebrate this particular short-term victory or to excoriate it, or he should just let it pass. It wasn't a great victory as far as great victories go in Congress. And the president setting himself up for a future defeat. He's bluffing on many of these issues. And Republicans on Capitol Hill they're starting to back away from him, and they don't take him particularly seriously at this particular point.
But in terms of, you're just saying that maybe the Congress is, they're calling Trump's bluff and it's not working. And I don't know at what point he becomes like the character in The Wizard of Oz, where you pull back the curtain and there's a sort of frightened, timid man there. But and maybe that's the direction we're heading in. But just...
Well, metaphors abound. is like the boy who cried wolf.
Right.
I mean, we can call him bluffer-in-chief. I mean, you bluff so many times, or you say you're going to do something rough and tough, and you're going to go nuclear, and you're going to slice off this, you're going to break the filibuster that. You don't do it. You can't do it. They're false, impossible claims, impossible bluffs, so that people start to say, you know, he's bluffing all the time. Now, there may come a point at which he finally holds true to what to his threats, and Congress may have to deal with it. But right now, Congress is writing him off. They do not see him as a credible ally. The Republicans do not see him as a credible ally. He has nothing or no record of rewarding members of Congress for their loyalty. He attacks the Freedom Caucus after Obamacare survives a repeal effort. I mean, he has very few friends in Washington right now. Now, people are still scared of him to some degree, but he doesn't raise funds. He doesn't provide perquisites. He doesn't do the things that incumbents need to get reelected. I mean, at some point, members of Congress have to say, look, we're going to go it alone. We're going to try to hammer out bipartisan agreements with the Democrats. And at that particular point, you can see how the Republicans are being backed into a corner. That's when the Democrats should keep quiet. They've got Trump and the Republicans where they want them. But if they celebrate too much, they galvanize the Republicans and the base to move forward. You know, it's too early for Democrats to go out partying. They should be studious and serious. No crowing, no clapping. Just continue on with their work.
Well, do you think, though, that Trump, I mean, I don't know that anybody controls him or influences him, and I'm not sure that he has much impulse control over himself. But he does seem to have this loyal base, which we saw in Pennsylvania on Saturday in this campaign rally that he went to. And the polls indicate that something like 86% of Republicans think that he's honest, trustworthy, and he's keeping his promises. And about 78% of Trump voters think that the mainstream media prints fake news. So they believe Trump's fake news, but they don't believe the mainstream press. So do you think that's insulating him? Does he believe that he's got that in his pocket? I don't know how long that can last. Do you?
Well, I don't know. He remade a bit of presidential campaign history. Everybody doubted him. They did the same when Truman ran in 1948. We've seen that happen before. Midterm elections are low turnout elections. It's very hard to get people out to the polls in both parties for a midterm. There's nobody at the top of the ticket. The president can run hard to help his loyalists, but it's a different kind of election. And if passed as prologue, presidents lose seats in midterm elections. Now, Democrats have an awful lot of senators up for reelection. It's going to be really hard to hold their 48 seats in the Senate. But, you know, President Trump can make the argument that he broke the mold before and he can do it again, but it's going to be a different kind of election. National elections, presidential elections are national in scope. The issues are national. Congressional elections, especially in the midterms, are local. What does my member of Congress do for my district? What kind of incumbent advantages did my member provide? Did he or she bring home some money for the district? Are we building new roads? Are we doing something to make my hometown better? They're not national elections in terms of tone. They're local. So, you know, President Trump would be misleading himself if he thought that campaign rallies with him standing by himself, not with a candidate who's running, are going to alter the election calculus. Nobody can be sure what's going to happen with Donald Trump at the top of the ticket, and you're quite right to say he may have no impulse control. He certainly has no Twitter control, and there is always the possibility that he'll nationalize the 2018 elections, and we'll have a further knockdown in the Democrats over in the Senate, and they'll pick up some seats in the House. Doubtful, long odds against it, but, you know, you can't count Trump out, and you're right about his loyal base, but that loyal base has to turn out, and this is not a national election. It's a local seat-by-seat, district-by-district election, so we'll see what happens.
But do you think that what happened in the last election still holds in the sense that status quo politicians like Hillary Clinton were roadkill, whereas the insurgent promising all kinds of things like Trump was the upstart and surprise winner. And that goes to the extent of alienation that's out there, particularly amongst Trump supporters, that they don't trust the government, they don't believe the government, they're fed up with it.
Right.
And an outsider who trashes the government gets their vote. Do you think that'll work work a second time?
It could. I mean, that's what got the Republicans, helped the Republicans win the House in 2010. That's what helped them win the Senate. In 2014, these were both midterm elections where the president's party often suffers. Whether or not this president's party will benefit from this particular president is doubtful, I'd say, at this point, but we'll follow the polls. His supporters like him. Whether his supporters will get up on election day to vote for the local member of Congress, I don't know. Depends on what's happened in their district. Presidents frequently try to take congressional elections national. It's a long, you know, strategy. Let's make this about Donald Trump, or let's make this about Barack Obama's his agenda, or let's make this about George W.'s agenda. But it tends to fall flat. You're running in a large number of districts, and you've got a relatively small number of members who are in competitive races. I don't know that Donald Trump is going to make that much of a difference, but if he takes the Republicans down the path to a shutdown and his base starts to realize that they're losing the things they like, they can't get into the, you know, they don't have the support they need. They're worried about Homeland Security. They're worried about this or that. Shutdowns are brutal. And we have the Washington Monument syndrome, in which federal agencies will shut down the most important programs, the most visible programs, to make the point that government does deliver a lot of benefits that Americans do want. And that's the dilemma for President Trump. Moreover, you know, at some point his base has got to say, okay, will the real Donald Trump please stand up? Was it the person who tweeted at 5 a.m. or spoke to the press at 9:15 or tweeted again later in the day or sent Sean Spicer out to announce his position at 6:30? We don't know how long that particular style can last before even his base starts to bleed off a little bit.
So in effect, we're back to our original question, which is, are the Republicans, because they've pushed this mantra of government being the problem, as Reagan said, and in other words, the anti-government rhetoric, is it catching up with them or is it still resonating? Because if the midterms are a referendum on what have you, the senator or the congressman, done for me lately, that implies that the voter expects some kind of functioning government.
Well, look, there's a real ambivalence in public opinion and among Americans about government. They think it wastes a lot of money. They think it's corrupt. They think that the federal government needs very major reform. They want it to get more efficient. They're angry. They're frustrated. They don't trust government to do the right thing. Those kinds of broad anti-government sentiments. But when you say to them, do you like the Centers for Disease Control? Do you like the Environmental Protection Agency? Do you like the federal employee who delivers the mail? So forth and so on. There's a reserve of interest in federal programs, in federal protections. So there's this ambivalence in the public, and we have to understand that. Republicans play to the anti-government sentiments. Democrats play to the benefits you're going to get, your Social Security, your Medicare, your protection from unsafe food and drugs, so forth and so on. You know, you get this back and forth, and at the local level, you start talking about the potholes that haven't been fixed. You start talking about the president's failure to deliver on his grand infrastructure agenda, not a dollar in the budget for that big infrastructure plan. And how does the wall help my district? You know, so you get that tension. It's not a one or the other. You've got the parties kind of dividing on government having an appropriate role in certain areas, and that's being threatened. And then you have government waste 51 cents out of every dollar, and that's what Americans actually believe. You ask Americans how much money the federal government wastes, they say more than half of every dollar. It's really quite remarkable. But then you ask them, well, do you think the federal government has a major role in health care or protecting us from terrorism or strengthening the economy? And they say, yes, 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 we want government to be involved. We don't want, you know, to be left out there in the cold. So you've got that tension, and we'll see how it plays out in 2018. But I'd say right now, many Republicans are in Capitol Hill are saying, look, we don't want to be the party of shutdowns and closures in national parks and, you know, threats from unsafe food and drugs and so forth. And I'd say they've got the advantage. Republicans need to figure out how to keep government open while meeting the public's concern about making government work better. That was the tension in the election, and Trump came out barely ahead.
Well, Paul Leiter, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure entirely.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Leiter, who is the professor of public service at New York University and the founding principal investigator of the Global Center for Public Service. Previously, he served as the founding director of the Center for Public Service and director of the Governmental Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. He's the author of Thickening Government and the Tides of Reform, and his latest book is Government by Investigation, Presidents, Congress, and the Search for Answers, 1945 to 2012. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the possibility that an impeachment of Donald Trump is all but inevitable.
Send in the clowns. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my usual.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Kuttner, the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect and a professor at Brandeis University's Heller School. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone and chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. His latest book is Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity Versus Possibility, and he has an article at billmoyers.com, Corporate America and Donald Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Kuttner.
Always happy to be back.
Well, thank you, Bob. And what do you make of the latest behavior of Donald Trump? Well, a couple of days ago, but he had this interview with CBS's Face the Nation anchor, John Dickerson, who was a very sort of mild-mannered centrist journalist, I think. But Trump clearly cannot admit he's wrong, refuses to apologize, and doubles down. I mean, he cut the interview off because he simply wouldn't answer how he could possibly justify calling Obama a bad, sick guy. What did you make of it?
Nothing new. This is who Donald Trump is. I mean, this is what we've come to expect. And I think the game of, you know, trying to get him to admit things in interviews, and I'm not even sure it's worth the trouble. But I mean, it keeps reminding us of what a crackpot he is. I thought the Andrew Jackson preventing the Civil War was even weirder.
Well, that's a frightening display of ignorance, which, you know, even I think high school kids would be ashamed of. But do you think that, I mean, you wrote a piece back 1 week in, back at the end of January, where you said the inevitability of impeachment after just 1 week. Do you think we're heading in that direction?
Well, it certainly depends on two things. It depends on exactly what these investigations demonstrate and whether there's some kind of a smoking gun. And, of course, politically, it also depends on whether Democrats take back the House in the 2018 midterm election, which I have to say is looking more and more likely. But, you know, Ian, I think the most interesting thing that's happened in the past few days that is emblematic of the potential weakness of Trump is how the Democrats just cleaned the Republicans' clock on the budget deal. Really quite amazing. The Democrats, after all, are the minority party. The Republicans have the votes. But the fact that the Republicans in the deal to keep the government open through September completely ignored Trump's budget requests, and the fact that they couldn't once again do anything to thwart the Affordable Care Act, and the fact that National Institutes of Health, which the Trump administration wanted to slash, got $2 billion additional funding, the fact that Planned Parenthood was protected, the Republicans were either completely outplayed by the Democrats, or they showed how divided they were, or they showed how they don't give a damn about Trump's priorities, all of which I think demonstrates that the latent divisions between Trump and the Republican caucus in Congress never really went away. I mean, this was a guy who most Republicans really detested. They held their nose, and they were willing to use him, you know, to get things like a Supreme Court seat and other goals like deregulation, but they don't exactly like him. And when he comes up with a completely crazy budget plan, they're perfectly willing to throw him under the bus. So that's what my takeaway is of the past few days. I think Trump is just stunningly weak.
So does this mean then that Pence is waiting in the wings? He's more their guy, isn't he, in terms of the Republicans?
Yeah, but you know, I have this argument with lots of people. People say to me, oh, well, you wouldn't want Trump impeached because then you'd get Pence. Well, first of all, if Trump were to be impeached, the far-right base, they'd be ripped. They'd feel completely betrayed by Congress. And Pence is not the kind of far-right, right-wing populist icon that Trump is. That's point number one. Point number two, after the impeachment of a Republican president, the Republican Party would be weakened. The Democrats would be set up to take the White House in 2020. And I think the fact that Pence is not as crazy as Trump, that's a plus. It's not a minus. And don't forget, this is a guy who was set up to lose the governorship of Indiana, not exactly a left-wing state. It's why he was one of the few people willing to even consider being on a ticket with Trump. He's not a skilled politician. So, of course, I'd rather have Pence. I'd especially rather have Pence after the humiliation of an impeachment.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Kuttner, the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect and a professor at Brandeis University's Heller School. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. His latest book is Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity Versus Possibility, and he has an article at BillMoyers.com, Corporate America and Donald Trump. So,
speaking of I.F. Stone, I have to share something with your listeners. A long, long time ago, there was a young film student named Jerry Bruck, who did a documentary about Izzy Stone, and it was impossible to find. Somebody just put it up on YouTube, and if you Google I.F. Stone's Weekly, which is the name of the documentary, you will be in for a treat. So I just wanted to plug Izzy Stone.
Well, we'd be in for a treat if there was something even resembling Izzy Stone at work in Washington today. Is it?
Well, there sort of is. I mean, I think the generation of of blogs and new media. Josh Marshall, former writing fellow of the American Prospect and TPM, Matt Iglesias and Ezra Klein, two other graduates of the American Prospect and with Vox. You know, these, they're not maybe as left-wing as he was, but they're independent journalism in his spirit. So I would like to think that he lives on.
Well, I was also referring, though, not so much to his politics, but to his assiduous investigation into government small print.
And all using the public record.
Right, right.
So,
and I wonder
what's going to happen to the public record.
Right, with these people, there is a real Orwellian quality to what Donald Trump is doing and how he has 86% of his base believing he's honest and trustworthy and will fulfill his promises, when 78% of his voters believe that the mainstream media prints fake news and they believe Trump's fake news and not the real news coming from the New York Times, or should I say the failing New York Times. So,
yeah, I think one of the really interesting questions is how far you can go on cognitive dissonance. So Trump voters were willing to forgive the fact that his program was going to screw a lot of people who depended on Medicaid, and they were willing to forgive the fact that his strategy for labor regulation was going to harm a lot of the very people who voted for Trump. And you can go on and on and on. And the kind of the crowning glory of this was his tax proposal, which is, you know, totally a billionaire's tax plan. At some point, people are going to start, even if it's only 10 or 15% of the people who voted for Trump, they're going to start saying this guy's just another politician. That's just inevitable.
Well, what do you think, though, in terms of the timeline here? Because one week in, and you were saying that the inevitability of impeachment. My sense is that obviously he brought them to the dance. He's delivered power to the Republicans, but they don't necessarily need him anymore. He's very embarrassing, I think. And one of the unique things about the American political system is our head of state is an elected politician, not somebody like the Queen of England. And the American people expect a certain modicum of dignity in their head of state, and I don't think they're getting it from this guy. In fact,
you know, my timeline goes something like this, that sometime this year, the investigations will show that, at the very least, there was a tacit understanding between Putin and the Trump campaign, and they will show that Trump is personally profiting from holding high office and puts the interests of his businesses ahead of the interests of the United States, and that violates the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. It also violates a couple of statutes. And then I think we have to wait for Democrats to take back the House. Now, when Democrats take back the House, and I think they will, I mean, don't forget, there are 23 House seats held by Republican incumbents that whose districts were carried by Hillary Clinton in a really crappy campaign, and you only need 24 to take back the House, and there are another 25 to 30, depending on who you listen to, that are considered in play. So I think there's a very, and also, by the way, since, even though a lot of people focus on the fact that the Senate has the arithmetic against Democrats taking back the Senate, the pattern in the first off-year election going back a century is for the president's party to lose about 30 seats. So I think Democrats take back the House. I think then the possibility of a bill of impeachment is very, very real. And if you compare this with Nixon, the Watergate break-in was the spring of 1972, before the election. And it wasn't until August of 1974, almost 2.5 years later, that Nixon was thrown out of office or was forced to resign following an impeachment by the House and about to be convicted by the Senate. So these things take time to build, but I still would be willing to wager that Donald Trump will not serve out his term.
But is there another possible scenario, given that My thought is that, you know, they'd probably be happy with Pence. I'm sure the Koch brothers, he's their protege. The DeVos family are close to him because of their religiosity. And that isn't it possible that they can't dump him now because it's not going to help them with the midterms. But if it's a wipeout in the midterms, do you think that they could find a way to use the 25th Amendment or some way to get rid of him?
Conceivably, but if he were to survive a Democratic takeover of the House, you know, you can just not renominate him. That's another way to get him out. But I think Republicans tossing him out of office would really split the party and would infuriate the Trump base, which is part of the Republican coalition. So I would put my money on the Democrats winning the midterm, and enough of a smoking gun coming out from all of these elections, and then the Democrats filing a bill of impeachment.
Well, not to be conspiratorial then, what explains the dysfunction now? They can't, you know, this repeal and replace, second bite of the apple, get rid of Obamacare, that's still hanging in the balance as far as I know, and they still haven't taken it to the floor, but at any moment they may. But given the bipartisan agreement not to shut down the government, and now Trump's talking about a good shutdown in September, I think he means October, you get the impression, well, let me ask you this, are they incompetent at governance because of their anti-government bias, or are they sabotaging Trump? What's going on? I'm talking about...
Well, there are 20 or 30 or 40 Republicans who were worried about their own re-elections. And I think the fact that progressive groups have learned something from the Tea Party and have been stalking Republicans in swing districts who are vulnerable if they vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act, that actually has some impact. I think Republicans also listen to some of their big business constituents, and that cuts one way when you're talking about a tax cut, but it cuts another way when you're talking about continuing to fund the National Institutes of Health. And they may be reprehensible in their ideology and their policies, but they're not as crazy as Trump is. And so even though there's a nominal majority, he doesn't control the whole caucus. And even the Tea Party feels free to thumb their nose at him. And so you've got kind of a three-way fragmentation between the two different wings of the Republican Party in Congress and then between Congress and Trump. And that adds up certainly to a kind of dysfunction.
But does that mean then that the Democrats bragging at the moment, as Chuck Schumer and others are, is not very smart politically? A previous guest, Paul Light, was saying he thought it was a big mistake on their part. And it sounds bad from what you're saying, that when the Republicans are self-destructing, the best thing the Democrats can do is get out of their way.
Yeah, I think that's a good rule of thumb. I mean, the Democrats have had such a hard time under Trump that You just in terms of human nature, you can't blame Schumer or Pelosi for, you know, feeling good about themselves for once. And I think Pelosi, by the way, gets a huge amount of credit for this. I mean, you know, some people dismiss her as kind of time for her to retire and let's get a younger person in there. There's nobody better as a progressive legislative strategist than Nancy Pelosi. And the fact that she just took them to the cleaners on the budget deal is proof of just how good she is and how dysfunctional they are.
Well, let's broaden that out then to the Democratic Party itself and its electoral prospects. It's obvious to me that the base, judging by what happened the day after Trump's inauguration, this spontaneous outpouring of women across the country and around the world, and there have been subsequent demonstrations almost every weekend with huge numbers, it's pretty clear that the base of the Democratic Party is riled up and more active than I've ever seen them.
And more progressive, by the way.
And more progressive, but there's no leadership. So the political energy is not being coupled with leadership and direction. Is that going to happen? What do you see happening on the horizon, given that Bernie Sanders is not getting any younger and Biden is definitely too old? What do you see on the horizon there?
Well, you know, I could argue this both ways. On the one hand, the Democratic bench is dangerously thin, especially at the level of people who might be credible candidates for president. That's certainly true. On the other hand, somebody always emerges. You know, we haven't had an election where the Democrats failed to come up with a candidate. So they will come up with a candidate, and it either will be a galvanizing candidate or it won't. But, and you know, you can play the game of mentioning the four or five people who might be effective candidates. But I think that will play out. And it would be nice if the bench were deeper, but it isn't. So in the meantime, the vacuum gets filled by all of this wonderful grassroots energy, which is not so bad, by Indivisible and all the other groups, regenerating politics at the grassroots, which is just what we need to do. And I think the view of Tom Perez as merely a cat's paw for Obama or for Hillary, I think that was too oversimplified. Perez is a very good guy, and I think the fact that he is working with Keith Ellison and rebuilding a 50-state party, I think that's good.
And he's working with Bernie Sanders, by the way.
Yeah, well, Ellison, of course, having been Sanders' candidate for chairman of the DNC, but yes, very much working with Sanders and trying to bring the party together. Although the kindest thing that the Clinton wing of the party could do right now is to go away. I mean, the future of the Democrats belongs to the progressive wing of the party, and that's where the activism is coming from, and that's clearly where the next nominee will come from, whether it's somebody such as Elizabeth Warren or Sherrod Brown. It will not be Andrew Cuomo or somebody from the Wall Street wing of the Democratic Party.
Well, just in closing, the record indicates that for every Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, you get a Dukakis, Mondale, Gore, or Kerry. So I hope somebody along the Obama-Clinton lines as opposed to the others.
Well, but, you know, Clinton was Typhoid Mary.
Mm-hmm.
He survived and everybody else got sick.
Same with Obama, by the way.
Yes, that's right. They were nimble politicians who were toxic for American progressivism. Mm-hmm. So this time we need somebody who's a skilled politician, who's also a true progressive and not a Wall Street person. And it was just terribly dismaying to see Obama, who's worth $13 or $14 billion, feeling that, you know, he needs to take a $400,000 honorarium for one speech underwritten by Cantor Fitzgerald, a Wall Street firm. And that's 10 times what the average American worker makes in a year. And A, he doesn't need the money. B, it's a terrible signal to send. So the sooner that the faces who represent the Democratic Party can be true progressives, the better off we will all be.
Well, Robert Kuttner, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Kuttner, who's the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect and a professor at Brandeis University's Heller School. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. His latest book is Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus Possibility, and he has an article at BillMoyers.com, Corporate America and Donald Trump. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.